Good evening. Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 9th, 2001. In the fireside room this evening, we are holding a forum. Today's session number is FO 2001-13, and it's titled Holden Village, the Climate, the Next 40 Years. Let's listen in.
I'm sure a few more people may come in with ice cream cones, but as usual, they'll know how to get in. My name is Randall Mullins. I'm here to moderate tonight. I'm here teaching on the teaching staff a couple of weeks, and great to be at Holden. Our topic tonight is the climate, Holden Village, and the next 40 years. I was just sitting here with Christopher and David in a little preliminary conversation, and already reminded that I think I feel a little like Paul's parents from his sermon tonight. You know, is there some stuff about this I don't think I want to hear? But we are here to hear it. You probably already know David Carlson brings a rich background in oceanography, and now with the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. And Christopher Gilja is the operations manager here at Holden Village. So they're going to share just a few minutes each. David, from a perspective of just where we are in our climate, but especially as it relates to a place we all care deeply about, Holden Village. And then Christopher's going to share a little bit to make a few more local connections here, and then we'll open up the conversation. So, David?
Good. Thanks for coming, folks. We've had a lot of fun this week. I think this is a chance to chew around some ideas. What I like to do is, unfortunately, those of you who've been coming to the talks, we're going to see the same old figure, and we'll go to that one, but it will be new to some people. And then toss in a couple of provocative ones and see where that takes us. Let me start with the story. As I was thinking about this week and information I could bring to Holden, I read a story about a series of villages in the Andes. These are high in the Peruvian Andes. And these are, what do we call them, HVVs, High Valley Villages. And I thought, well, that sounds like Holden. And it turns out these villages are functioning on glacial water. So there's snow fields in the Andes. These snow fields melt during the summer, and that water is used by these villages for both irrigation and power, as a matter of fact, hydroelectric power. And in this case, the glaciers are melting fast. They're receding. And so the villagers are enjoying a temporary boon. They have more water for power, and they have more water for irrigation, and things are looking good. But that boom will end in about 20 years. And at that point, those permanent snow fields will be gone, and they will have to rely on whatever they can get annually or whatever they can do otherwise. Well, then I went up to the museum, and I looked at the Lyman Glacier pictures, and I saw the receding extents of that, and then I read the energy budget, energy assessment that Chris and the staff have done about what Holden has. And I realized that Holden likewise relies on snowfield water. We've been asking ourselves whether it's each year's annual snowfall or whether it's the previous accumulated snowfall in the glaciers, but relies on it for both power and for the water that we use during our visits. So it struck to me that here's a local example shared with another High Valley village and probably shared worldwide. And so I want to bring this issue back to Holden. And I'm going to start with a global projection. Most of you have seen it, or many of you have seen it at this point. This is the current projection about what's going to happen with climate. So, oops. Can you hit the back arrow? There we go. Okay. We'll just do three quick ones of these, and we'll turn the projector off, and we'll be out of your way. Sam, you've already seen this. So this is time across the bottom from about 1750 to 2100. So it's got a projection in the future. And this is temperature change from the current in degrees Celsius. Now, I've been telling all of our classes that because this has a lot of uncertainty, just convert these by a factor of 2. So 5 Celsius is 10 Fahrenheit. Okay? That's close enough. So here's a line that says 10 Fahrenheit. Okay? And this is a series of projections about what climate is going to do from the point today 100 years out. And here's one that says climate is going to warm by 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay? These are different scenarios, and this one means fossil intensive. FI means fossil intensive. So this is continuing to burn fossil fuels as we do today. But I want to draw your attention to this scenario here, this green line, which is actually the lowest temperature rise. It's still about 2.5, let's call that 5 Fahrenheit, over 100 years. But you can see it starts to level off. This one just keeps going up. And it has a lower temperature rise. And so the question is, what's the difference between this scenario and this scenario? And so what I'd like to do is start by reading you the assumptions that went into this scenario. A convergent world with a global population that peaks in mid-century and then declines. A rapid change in economic structures toward a service and information economy. Reductions in material intensity. Material intensity is just how much we use, how much we consume. And the rapid introduction of clean and resource-efficient technologies. This scenario has an emphasis on global solutions to economic, social, and environmental sustainability, including improved equity. What are these guys, nuts? That's as ideal a scenario as I've ever heard. You know, any author that we're reading this week or that we're talking about this week could put together those kind of ideal terms. So I think a question I'd like to provoke tonight is, what does it take to get from where we are to that favorable scenario? And I'm not talking about technology. I think we're talking about society. What does it take? Now, even at that scenario, right here, there are going to be changes. At that warm, most of the snow fields that we enjoy in the view around here will melt. I said the other night that I think in 4 or 5 years we'll have a very accurate prediction, but I think that prediction will say something like for the North Cascades, temperature will be, in all seasons, a couple degrees warmer. And winter precipitation will likely be the same or slightly larger, but summer precip will probably be lower. So those are the kind of challenges that I'm going to give Chris. Now, before we talk about what Holden would do in that scenario, I just want to show you two other things that are completely weird, but they're meant to be provocative. This is world advertising expenditures per person, 1950 to 1998. And if you can see the numbers here, here's 1950, here's 1998, that's a pretty regular increase. This number in 1997 dollars is $70 per person world advertising. How many people in the world? 6 billion. 6 billion times 70 is $420 billion in advertising. What's that advertising going for?
Consumption.
Pharmaceuticals is all first. What's second?
Automobiles.
Energy. That's what we're up against, folks. That's what the opposition is spending at this point. Okay? Now, I thought, well, that's a nice trend. I really looked around a lot, and I use World Watch a lot. They're really a marvelous source. I looked around for something that's going up as fast as temperature. Any ideas?
No, that's linear. Remember, temperature's going like this.
Energy consumption?
Energy's going pretty much the same as population. All right, let's go to the next one. This is what I found. Internet host computers, 1981 to 1999. Man, look at that takeoff. Now, the problem is, most of those, of course, are dumping advertising onto your website. So they're, you know, they're doing just what we saw. But the point I want to make here is, maybe there's a new technology out there that can help us establish connections, especially global connections. And maybe, even though 90% of it might be going for advertising, maybe there's 10% of it that's an interesting piece that we could start thinking. So that's where I want to leave you. Just a couple of ideas. And thanks for coming. Like you, I'm very interested to see what Chris is going to do with my climate scenario that I did.
Chris, hold.
Well, the question for tonight is how will global warming, how will climate change affect Holden Village? And I'm not going to answer that question. I'm going to ask more questions. It certainly will affect us here. And how much it does, we don't know. It is a lot of degrees of what could happen. But we will, and we have already, have to adjust to a certain amount of climate change here. I think we're probably going to be better off here than most places. If there is rapid or extreme climate change, it could be the end of this place here, but then again, it'll be the end of a lot of places. So let's start with something a little less dramatic than that. What if we have just a little bit less annual snowfall? Already, we experienced a lot of extreme flow differences in Copper Creek. Copper Creek comes out of Copper Basin, which is our watershed behind the village. We're dependent upon Copper Creek for our electricity and for all of our drinking water and for our fire protection. Right now, we don't begin to use all that water in the summertime. We have all the electricity we can use, way more than we can use, and there's still plenty of more water. In the wintertime, as it starts to freeze up, we start gradually to use more and more percentage of it. Finally, we use all of it, and then we start burning firewood and diesel fuel. So we can get by with less Copper Creek water than we have right now in the summertime, and already we could use more in the wintertime. And ironically, if there's less in the wintertime, we'll need to burn more fuel, more diesel, and more firewood. If that flow continues to reduce and even reduces the flow in Copper Creek, Railroad Creek would be our alternative hydroelectric source. So if Copper Creek were to diminish to the point where it wasn't suitable for hydroelectric production any longer, we could build a hydroelectric plant on Railroad Creek. If that starts going down, then we'll start seeing lower water levels in Lake Chelan. And then we'll need to build a new dock. If we have drier weather in this valley, it could mean a greater chance of that big forest fire, which may happen someday in this valley. If we do survive that forest fire, then the threat will be diminished for a while. We'll have less vegetation, we'll be able to do less irrigation. But again, the thing that we'll be affected with first is electricity. We use just a small fraction of the summer water for electricity now, and a small fraction of that water for drinking water. So Copper Creek would really have to disappear altogether for us to be affected as far as drinking water goes. And then we could move to Railroad Creek, and as Railroad Creek is diminished, as up valley water sources dry up, again, we would have to have Railroad Creek completely disappear before we'd have no drinking water. But we would need another power source. Other power sources would likely mean fuel. In the summer, we could possibly use solar cells. In the winter, there's very little sunlight here. We'd likely have to, again, burn more firewood and more diesel fuel. It's possible that we would have actually a little more snowfall here in the wintertime. If that were the case, maybe we would experience more avalanches. More avalanches on the road, possibly even threatening the village. More snow makes travel more difficult. It makes maintaining our buildings more difficult. But it may mean better power. Sometimes climate changes mean increased violent weather. Maybe there'll be more storms, more lightning, which could mean more forest fires. Could have more high winds, which would affect our power lines. You know, one thing we do not have right now is very much violent weather. So that could possibly change. But almost all these changes that could happen to Holden Village due to climate change can be dealt with depending on the severity of it, but they all require spending more money. Either developing new hydro plants, or putting in a diesel generator, or possibly even relying on Chelan PUD and throwing in our lot with everybody else out there as far as what's available for electricity. Building solar cells, buying more fuel, drilling wells, using electricity to pump water rather than relying on gravity feed. We'd want to put in a larger water reservoir if stream flows were diminished. That would be expensive. Severe weather would mean building upgrades to withstand more severe weather. Perhaps new bridges on Railroad Creek if flooding became an issue. And more fire protection measures and more avalanche protection measures. But the very first thing we'd likely see is reduced annual flows in Copper Creek, which would affect our hydroelectric generation, and that's already something we deal with every single year. So we know how to do that. As it gets worse over time, we'll have to look for alternative sources of electricity first and finally drinking water.
Thank you. Thank you both. And let's just open it up here, and I'll just suggest make a few suggestions that might help our conversation a bit. If you're one of those people who never asks a question or makes a comment in a gathering this large, and tonight you have one, consider letting this be the night when you put one out. And I also want to just encourage all of us, this is pretty technical material for a non-technical person like me, but let's not be afraid to ask a question that sounds too naive or not sophisticated scientifically, so we're in a safe place to put them all out there. And if you want clarification from either a question from the audience or from Christopher or David, please feel free to just get clear, and that'll, I think, help our communication. So yes, Paul.
I don't know if I want to address this to David or anybody in the audience, too, that might answer. What kind of access do these kinds of scientific facts have to the media and to political leaders?
They have excellent access. I'm showed a lot of information from this IPCC report, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. A copy of that is on the desk of every congressional staffer, every congressional member, every cabinet member. You may recall that Bush came back from Europe and asked the National Academy to produce him a quick report on what the U.S. should do about climate change. That figure that I just showed you is in that report. So is the one we talked about today, about the 1,000-year climate crisis. It's not a... I think there's a sense, especially when we hear it for the first time, we see it, we say, wow, boy, if other people heard this, things would change. They've heard it. Things aren't going to change. There's got to be some other route.
George?
Simple question. Is there a more efficient power plant rather than the old generators that are being used? Aren't newer hydro power plants more efficient?
Could we generate more electricity with less water?
With the same amount of water?
The new system. A marginal amount more, yes. The limiting factor is the amount of water and the amount of head, and if those things don't change, modern equipment may increase at a percentage, maybe 10%. But probably not more than that.
What about fuel cells?
Tell me about fuel cells.
When they're coming along, it's just a glorified battery. Have we looked at that?
We have a group here called the Science and Technology Committee, which is meeting this month later in the village, and there's a group of engineers on that committee that's looking into fuel cells. It's pretty early to know if they can be helpful to the village, but it is a possibility.
Could you explain what they are, please?
Just what they are. They're just the
battery banks?
It's a glorified battery. It's using hydrogen and...
I'd like to ask David if fuel cells is a, you know, we're starting to hear that word, you know, in a few years, are we going to have cars that run on fuel cells and hydrogen and instead of the gasoline? Does it have strong implications for the kind of information you're presenting us here?
Eventually, petroleum's going to run out. That's just a fact. Coal won't run out, but we don't want to burn all that. Natural gas will run out shortly. If you look at the way our economy has evolved, our energy economy, we've moved from coal to oil, and now we're moving from oil to natural gas. We need to move the next step. At each one of those steps, we've gained because we produce less CO2 for the amount of energy we get out. The next step is hydrogen. Fuel cells are a little pocket version of it now, but the national and global economy needs to go to hydrogen. Does the current energy plan say anything about hydrogen? The current energy plan is going back to petroleum. The future is actually very clear. Hydrogen is the future, and that's exactly where we have to go. But at the moment, there's no motivation to take even the exploratory steps to get there.
Our present hydro is pretty efficient, isn't it? At least I have that impression in terms of the amount of power it gets because of the high head.
You're about here at Holden.
Yeah.
The equipment itself was built in the 1920s, and there is more efficient equipment available. But the amount of head we have is the limiting factor, along with the flow. And because we have so much head, we're able to do pretty well with the amount of flow we have.
What does head mean?
The amount of feet above the powerhouse where the intake is located.
It's the water pressure, essentially.
Right.
The higher the source, the more head pressure.
So we could go further up, increase the head even more, and we would get more electricity for the given flow. That would be one way to increase, I don't know if you'd call that efficiency, but increase the amount of power we'd get.
You mentioned using diesel fuel. What about using biodiesel? There's three commercial facilities in the United States now producing it. Made from French fried. Fryer fat. All your diesel engines that smell just like a McDonald's store.
Just what we need.
The village has a diesel generator, which is our backup source of electricity, and it can provide about a third of what our hydroelectric plant can produce. And since it's located a little ways outside the village, we could probably tolerate the McDonald's.
Well, I'd like to get back to the original opening question here, and that's kind of awareness. We've heard that our congressmen have this information, and that the government has this information. But except for those people in this room, and probably a few other fistfuls of people in other rooms, who do the general public, are they aware of it? I mean, I haven't seen very many commercials of all this money being spent talking about this issue. I mean, we hear about it. We hear about global warming, and we hear about the ozone, and I think you made a point earlier, David, that since the CFCs have been eliminated, that some of the ozone damage appears to be being taken care of, but that still is not eliminating our problem. So I'm wondering if maybe there needs to be some more real grassroots awareness made so that we can go to our politicians and say, do it or you're out of here.
Raise a good... You had a question earlier, did you?
Oh, I was just going to ask a little question. Is fuel cells what they use in electric cars, or is that something totally different?
Electric cars are actually mostly today conventional batteries. Sometimes they're hybrid where they've got a rechargeable battery and a small petroleum source. There are some experimental cars that use fuel cell technology. There are some experimental small power plants that use fuel cell technology. I'm going to go back to this question. I was hoping somebody else would respond to it. I don't want to be the responder. This is an economic issue. We can vote all we want, folks. Our votes are already bought and paid for by the energy company. So unless we're willing to act economically, I don't think we have any role. And I think that comes exactly to your question. Unless individually, we don't have any economic impact. By the tens, by the hundreds, by the millions, we do have economic impact. So unless we're willing to, in my mind, unless we're willing to act, send a signal to the economy, I don't think this is going anywhere. Once we do that, you know, things change fast. The politicians will be right behind us, believe me. But I think we have to change, I think we have to send a signal to the economy. So the question is, how do we do that individually? How do we do that collectively? And that's the point of putting the internet up there. Try these numbers. These are just guesses. I think the economy usually runs in millions of units. You know, an automobile maker sells, what? How many Explorers did Ford sell? 1.5 million or 3 million? I don't know. I just took the fact that they recalled 3 million tires, divided that by four, and came out. I don't know how else to do that. But my point is, I think 1 million units of anything, cereal, toothpaste, headache medicine, automobiles, the economy will feel that. The manufacturer will feel that. Well, there's 260 million of us in the country, right? Let's say a fifth of us, 20%, are enthused about this idea. So, okay, so there's 50 million of us. We only got to affect 1 million units. If Company X's sales of 1 million units of something fell to 500,000, bingo, they know it instantly. You don't have to wait till the vote gets counted in Florida. You don't have to do anything. Bingo. So the question is, do we have the willpower and the technology to organize ourselves so we can make ourselves felt in the economy? My feeling is, I don't care how much we vote, pray, wish, until we get felt in the economy, I don't think we're going anywhere.
Mm-hmm. Two economic things that I think are kind of interesting. One of the biggest lobbyists to address global warming, as far as I understand, is the property insurance business. They plunked a lot more money into lobbying than many environmental groups. So the allies could maybe come from surprising quarters. And at the same time, I've noticed on the New York Times op-ed page, you'll see sometimes advertisements from like Exxon that they seem to be targeted toward the Northern Belt agricultural region, saying, well, you know, maybe this global warming will actually just expand your growing season. And so they're admitting this, but it does seem to be that it's going to be played out on the economic ball field.
When's the last time you saw an energy company actually advertise energy? You ever see gas advertised? No! They advertise their service to the environment in the Gulf of Mexico. They advertise it grow, you know. That's why I put those advertising down. They're spending, folks. And until we're able to make ourselves felt some other way, it isn't going anywhere.
Where do I hear on the radio an example of those advertising dollars that energy companies spending, David? I'm not. It feels sort of hidden, is it?
Well, I think we talked about television.
They're advertising.
Public television, you know, they sponsor all the
automobile races, airplane races, I mean, any kind of motorsports.
Okay.
Baseball games.
Texaco supports the opera every Saturday morning.
Question?
Yeah, for David again. So say you had your web page up there and everybody was connected. What would you put on that page telling individuals to do?
I wouldn't tell anybody. What I would do is say, what's an issue that enough of us feel strongly about that we could coordinate? What was the What was the...
Was the summer solstice... Did anybody get that summer solstice message where there'd be like a rolling blackout across the country?
Yeah.
We got it, and we didn't ask for it, but it could be something like that.
It's maybe Randall could talk about some of the organizing background to the World Trade Organization protests, because I think there's our need. So let's go back to your question. I think the web is a wonderful way to share ideas. This figure could be on the web. People could debate it. They could say, you know, this and that. There are a lot of ways to get information out there. But we don't even have to pick the right issue first. We just have to pick an issue where we can show that a million people overnight can turn off their lights, stop buying Cheerios. I don't know what the issue is. The point is, start small, figure out how you put yourselves together. That's how the movements go, right? You figure out how you build your strength, you build your enthusiasm. I think you, myself, I'm not sure we could do this because it seems like it's going so upstream, but we stop buying SUVs.
What?
Okay, how many people in here own a vehicle that's built in the United States and gets less than 20 miles per gallon? How many of those people actually own a bicycle as well?
Minority, it looks like. Yeah. So.
Well, no, I don't want to get into pointing fingers. Well, there are a dozen energy smart things that we could do, some of which are not negative. They are votes for things rather than, you know, if somebody got, you know, a million messages saying, I'd be interested in solar hot water for my house. That's a positive step. There are ways to do that. I sense that there are a dozen issues that people could coalesce around and get behind. I'm more interested in what are the mechanisms? How do we do it?
Yeah, and I want to add to the question here also is to what extent does just information, Paul, maybe could you share your example about smoking in Slovakia that you shared the other day in class?
There is quite a lot of smoking among the young people in Slovakia, including the young people in the school where I teach, which is kind of cream of the crop kids. One out of three that registers or takes the test is accepted, and these are it's either the best or second highest rated high school in the whole of Slovakia. And the principal told us that we should do some instruction to the students about the dangers of smoking. And I said, well, what should I say? Well, they need to understand, you know, the dangerous effects, you know, the harmful effects of smoking and so on and so forth, and he educated them about it. I said, I don't think there's a student in this whole school that doesn't know the harmful effects of smoking, but I still had to do it, so I went and did it in class. I said, how many of you students don't know the harmful effects of smoking? And they laughed like you laughed. They all know that. It doesn't stop them doing it. I raised the question somewhat related to that I'm embarrassed for my own country. Because, I said, in our country, we've limited, somewhat at least, smoking advertising. But people over there say, we would love to do that too. But your government won't let us. I said, why is that? Because any country that receives any kind of aid from the United States, it is required to allow unlimited tobacco advertising, otherwise it is restraint of trade. Well, that's pre-WTO, I think, a little bit way back.
I think the questions are clear. Brad, you were good.
David, you said that hydrogen is the future. I guess my question is why isn't hydrogen on the table, and how do we vote it onto the table, or how does it get there?
Yeah, I like that question. Why isn't it? Because our national infrastructure is set up for petroleum. And even if you could figure out how to do hydrogen, then you've got an infrastructure switchover. You know, we've got to figure out how to fill our cars up with liquid or gaseous hydrogen. the infrastructure, I think, is dispersed, you know, local franchises as local this, but the supply is centralized. And I think that that system tends to argue against any kind of grassroots change, because, but I also think, you know, even if I didn't believe him, even if he said something, or Bush said something about an aggressive research plan into new hydrogen technologies, you know, at least it would be a maybe disingenuous nod in the right direction. We didn't even get that. We got nothing.
I live in Seattle, and I certainly don't pretend to be a sophisticated, you know, have any kind of sophisticated understanding of what went on in WTO there. But what was clear to me is that something shook loose in the world. Probably clear to you too. What's also clear to me, and I think you know this, but in case all you saw was windows breaking and black masks, that is not all that happened in Seattle. It was incredibly well organized, with people coming from all over the world and still coming from all over the world to these WTO meetings. So I just want to get into the conversation here. What is driving that? What is it besides information that gets us? What's the level? Maybe it's the deeper level beyond deeper than information that gets change to start happening. What does that? Go ahead.
Well, you raised the obvious points that, you know, things happen with grassroots, and that's the only way. So I just encourage everybody to go forth from Holden and speak with that group of people you're influential about, because everybody has a circle of friends and peers that, and that's how the word spreads. And you, just when you're talking about the WTO, and I was wondering how that can apply to people in this room, and a lot of ways that you don't understand, perhaps a retirement fund and where that money is invested. Because we might be thinking about how we can vote with our dollars on a small level, but investment money is a very big thing tying to the large corporations. Just put that on the table.
Yes?
I'd like to go back to the whole idea of economics, which has come up earlier. We live in California, and Northern California, which has had more of the impact of the energy crisis, which is now non-existent. But California, because of economics, we took out all our incandescent light bulbs and switched as many as we could to fluorescent. We bought a brand new refrigerator, and we decreased our electricity. When I dry my clothes, I hang them out on the line and only put them in the dryer to fluff them. For economic reasons, we cut our electricity down about 40%. And California did cut their electricity down by about 11 or 12% total for the whole state. Now that the crisis is not as big as it used to be, we haven't had any blackouts. People are using more electricity. The economics of it. Gas prices went up to close to $2 a gallon nationwide. And people, a friend of mine traded in her expedition, got rid of it. I think Americans, unfortunately, the general public, not the people at Holden, the general public react with their pocketbooks. The economics is very important.
I wonder, I'm just also reminded, and it's just a vestige of a memory, the cigarette advertising by the state of California a few years ago made smoking go down. Am I remembering that correctly?
I don't know.
You don't know? Okay.
The anti-cigarette.
Anti-cigarette.
That's what I meant, yeah.
I thought it was just badly done advertising. We could get them to do some other thing.
I was just going to say, I think that the story of the situation in the Andes is something that also moves people, but the Andes is a long ways away. Is there other stories that are similar, that are closer to home, that you're aware of?
Well, several people were talking today, people who are familiar with Alaska, and most of those, there are not many that enter at sea level anymore. Mm-hmm. Most of those have retreated. I don't know whether that's an economic or a tourism issue. closer to home. In large part, most of our snowfields in the lower 48 are decorative. A few places like Holden, you know, use them intensely, importantly, but, you know, for the most part, in Rocky Mountain Park and all the other parks are decorative. Then they're going to be gone. So I think you need to think globally. The Himalayas permanent snowpack is projected to be gone in 40 years. That's all of Bangladesh's irrigation water, folks. That's their entire irrigated agricultural land. You know, think of other places that depend on, you know, river flow and snowfield sources, and I think there's a lot of impact from that.
I've heard several groups. I don't know how reputable they are, but or lots of different sources saying that within the last 10 years, the United States has experienced its first cases of a lot of mosquito-borne illnesses like malaria, dengue fever, and other things like that. And a lot of people are making the connection to global warming. I'm curious to see if other people have heard that.
There's a, I'm reading you from Working Group 1. Working Group 1 is the physical climate, the kinds of things we've been talking about in our sessions this week. There's a Working Group 3, which is looking at infectious diseases. There's also a U.S. National Academy report on climate change and infectious diseases. And at this point, it's largely a collection of anecdotes. Reports of this, reports of that. I think in the southwest U.S., where we live, the relation of previous year's rainfall and vegetation to the, what's the virus?
The West virus.
No, the Hanta virus. It's actually pretty clear in the Four Corners there. So the sum of this report is they raise a list of serious issues. And it mentions exactly the examples that you talked about. But their summary, in a typical cautious scientific way, is it's too early to tell whether that's systematic, whether those are other biological factors that are driving that. This is the third assessment report of IPCC. The first assessment report said exactly the same thing. It's too early to tell. So I'm not making a prediction, but there are a lot of people looking at exactly that issue, and there's another whole volume this size asking exactly those questions.
I'm just noticing here that we were going to be very local here about Holden, and I'm having the impression that Christopher and others have done such a good job of studying it that there's not much... I didn't hear much anxiety for Holden itself in response to what you said here. Did I hear that right here? So, are you not too anxious about how all this relates to Holden?
Well, I started off by saying I thought we were in better shape than a lot of places. I think the anxiety is a more global nature than local nature. So, because there certainly is anxiety.
Yeah, so good. Some people who haven't asked some questions, anybody? Yes, no?
Talking about Holden, one of the pieces, I was thinking that actually if we have milder winters, less snowfall, you will be able to have hydroelectric power longer. It won't freeze as soon. And that will be beneficial. You won't have to run as much diesel.
Well, but if the snow has gone, there's nothing, so...
Well, I mean, a certain height is still going to have it. I think we're not saying that there's never going to be snow.
No, what we might be saying is that the snow that we see now, you know, the snow that lasts year after year after year, in which we draw down in the dry years, that might be gone. You might still get a good winter snowfall, but you might have to live on that year's input.
Okay.
And that might put Chris in a, you know, more of a good year, bad year sort of situation rather than, in fairness, between us, we didn't know what fraction of the water is current year snowfall and what fraction of the water is multi-year snowfall.
But the bigger scare to me is that you want to buy diesel fuel and everybody in the world is buying it and there's none available.
One of the things that we're doing very actively now rather than putting more money into upgrading the hydro plant or upgrading the diesel generators, is putting money into weatherization and remodeling. That's been a fairly aggressive program in the village, and we're going to continue that this winter on Lodge 1. If any of you want to come back this winter and work on looking for an electrician and a plumber. To reduce our dependence, not only on electricity, because we can't always depend on that, but on alternative fuel sources such as firewood and diesel. Hmm.
If it came to moving the hydro plant to depend on creek water, would the government permit that? Would you have to get permits from the Forest Service or the Department of Agriculture?
The village did a study on just that issue about 10 years ago and decided in part not to pursue a Railroad Creek Hydro because the permitting process was so expensive. We'd have to go through FERC, which is a very expensive process, and it's not guaranteed that we'd get a permit. It's theoretically possible, but we wouldn't know until we spent perhaps $500,000 before we'd have the answer.
It is about food. To the best of my knowledge, the liver of Holden's food source is grown here. So all that is eaten comes from elsewhere.
Yes.
And my question is, what is happening to food supply in your prediction for the future?
We would be in the same boat as everyone else. We wouldn't be any better off food-wise by living here.
I think you catch the essential dilemma. Mm-hmm. An affluent nation with resources to drill deeper and buy more fuel, you know, can sustain its food production, probably. What you see is the less affluent nations or dependent on, you know, water sources and I think you can see that under the pressure of energy shortages, warming, biological stresses, the haves and have-nots split gets larger. And that's why I called out in this scenario this global cooperation. I think the pressures are divisive, but the solutions have to be convergent. And that was my point about how do you get there? Because I think the pressures are going to, tend to throw us. Could the U.S. survive this? Sure, we'll just all move. We'll move up with you, actually. It'll be nice up there. But look at the current disparities. Do you think, is that going to improve under a world where the U.S. is holding more tightly to reserves and resources? And doesn't look great.
And David, is that the ultimate scenario, or is there a scenario beyond that where even the haves are in trouble?
There are scenarios where even the haves are in trouble. You could see a collapse of global fisheries. That's one scenario.
Because it seems like when we're stuck in the have-have-nots, it's the same old story of, well, how do you get to that ethical thing? How do you get people to do the right thing? And it's really, really hard.
It is.
What strikes me about this one is it's kind of like the nuclear dilemma that you have to think ahead to fix it because all of us are gone if we blow it up. And if the whole world is in trouble, that is what's going to, that has a pressure to make us come together. Whereas if that scenario isn't really the scenario, if it's kind of like, well, we'll have some of this, and then Bangladesh goes off the map, but we're still here. That isn't really going to bring us together. And I think we need to refine our arguments to kind of get that passion out there to say, look, this is serious, folks, and to break through the denial. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we're not going to get that coming together.
Well, this is all making me think of people migrating. I mean, if countries are being flooded, if people are having trouble getting food, if there's no water in places, people are going to be moving all over. And that would be an added chaos factor, and I think something that's going to, maybe finally make people real. I guess what I'm trying to say is there will be a lot of people in pain. And until those who aren't in pain are somehow forced to realize that there's pain going on and maybe even feel it themselves, you know, I don't know if there's going to be much happening. But were there studies on people moving according to climate change?
Oh, sure. And I think there's a very acute observation. People have always moved under those kind of pressure. There are one of the negative scenarios, one of the scenarios that does worse is one where issues are restricted to local and regional. They don't get global cooperation. And in that people, in that case, there are barriers to movement of ideas, movement of people. And I don't think there's, I'm not aware of studies that actually predict in a quantitative sense how much would move into where, but the disruption is included at a very low level. And these are very crude models. I was just surprised that this one had, you know, as many of the things that we talk about as equity, social change, global cooperation. That's pretty surprising to find in a technical climate model, actually. I like Scott's direction. Remember, what's that... what's mad, mutually assured destruction? Don't we have a similar scenario? I mean, is that what you're suggesting?
Somehow, because, I mean, if you only go so far, if you only go 40 years into the future, you know, we're kind of thinking about maybe we'll need to do a little more diesel, a little more wood, kind of. Whereas if you think 7 generations ahead, you know, we'll make the same. Where really are we in our grandchildren's grandchildren's time? Because that's, I think, that we have to think ahead. Otherwise, your study keeps saying, you know, it's already too late to stop what we started. Unless we think hundreds of years ahead, we're going to blow it up, we're going to mess it up too bad to fix it by the time we realize it. And I'm trying to get us to think further ahead than just, well, how are we going to fix the next step? How are we going to stop buying SUVs? It's way beyond SUVs. It's beyond, we can't all have our own cars. I mean, the planet can't sustain that kind of lifestyle.
Humans don't usually really think that way, though. I mean, most people don't. 40 years is a long time. Most people think past next week. And I think her point about pain is well taken. You know, as much as the pain is in Bangladesh where they don't have any irrigation, we'll send money, we'll be fine. And here we'll start, you know, like you said, when the gas was $2 a gallon and... somebody felt some personal pain because they couldn't get Crestown in their Explorer anymore. They got rid of the Explorer and did something different. And, I mean, in this country, we have resources and we can solve the problem for ourselves immediately. And that's how, I think, change slowly happens. You know, this is hurting me. Okay, I'll do this instead. And, oh, no, it's still hurting me. And we can shield it from a lot of that pain because we have the resources to make those changes. And it'd be nice if we would think 200 years ahead, but we're not gonna. And I think maybe what we need to do is figure out a way to cause some collective pain in our economy, like you said before. You know, if we could get gas to be expensive enough, people will stop buying it. When, I mean, myself, even we get our power from Bondel Power, and they sent out this stuff. You know, we have to reduce by 10% because there's this energy crisis, and they gave everybody coupons, and now, you know, everybody in Clark County has fluorescent light bulbs. You never saw so many light bulbs go out of a home base. It's like, it just was incredible they had. And because there was personal pain involved and some kind of way for us to deal with it in our little day-to-day way. And that's the way change takes place. And you can't get massive groups of people to think about 100 years from now.
But what happens if you don't? I've never seen it. What happens if you don't?
Yeah, I have a question about these studies. And have there been studies? I mean, they've been studying, you know, global warming for years and years and years, and people have written books about how the world's going to end, and, you know, because of things. But technology, you know, things do change. Are there any reports that came out 20 years ago that are true today? I mean, I'm just kind of playing devil's advocate.
I think it's a fair question. You couldn't see it on, down near the bottom, there was a black line that was near the lower part of those estimates. That was the second assessment. Yeah. So that shows where we thought we were 5 years ago. So you can see a progression of that. There are a variety of technological solutions. What does the information economy do? What does miniaturization of things do? These rosy scenarios assume the best possible results from all those technologies, but they also assume that we share them widely. There were predictions about sea level change. Those turned out to be actually quite accurate. There were predictions about changing the sort of storm systems, more intense rainfall, more intense storms. The hurricane ones have not proven out, but the change from a more even distribution of rain to more rain above 2 inches an hour, that turns out that has happened, at least in the Northern Hemisphere where you have good rain gauges and you can actually find the data. This has been an issue like a lot of others where, bingo, doomsday, and that's jumped on it, and the naysayers, you know, it's nonsense, that's jumped on it. The issue is still there, and it's getting serious in the sense that, you know, we're starting to show data that you can see the change. You can show statistically that it has to come from CO2. It can't come from somewhere else. I think a less well-grounded issue scientifically, as you say, having been looked at for 20 years, would have evaporated at this point. And this one's hanging in there.
How is the wind going to change in the next 40 years? Could we, like, make a wind generator or whatnot? Turn around and make wind power like that? We're in the middle of it.
There's some chance.
Like, if all the rivers and everything were dried up, and we can use, like, wind power as an alternative.
There are some hints that if you heat the earth up and the hydrological cycle runs faster, you get stronger winds. You probably get those in the storm tracks. Everyone who lives in Seattle knows about the Pacific storm track, and you know about winds. And those of you who hike up to Holden Lake know that occasionally you get winds enough to knock down big trees. I don't know here. I think Chris is right. I think it's actually a relatively protected. I don't think wind's generally a big factor as a storm. So I can't tell you what would happen locally. Places that get strong winds now, would they get stronger winds? Some suggestions that that's true. You know, how that distributes globally, I don't know how that suggestion.
Maybe it'll get us some more windmill. Yes, sir, you can.
It has to do with changing, and we had to change some different, worldwide changing powers. How would the, if it costs more money, how would the third world countries survive?
That's the equity issue. Suppose that a new proprietary technology that improves something, you know, is that going to be shared? I think the pharmaceutical industry is actually a good example to look at here. There are drugs that are known to be effective against diseases that are important in other countries. Do we share that technology widely? I don't see a good example.
They can buy it, yeah.
They can buy it,
It just seems to me about getting everybody to participate that mainly what we're talking about is one class in a huge range of classes within the world. And those different classes are either richer or poorer, or more motivated or less motivated. And there's quite a big majority of people who just don't care in the world. And they can look at global warming and they'll say, that's great, it's not going to affect me now.
Yeah. Same challenge of how to get people involved who may not feel the pain or may not have enough resources or time to do it yet.
I know we're cutting time. We had a forum here about 7 weeks ago, and they talked about the Hanford nuclear waste site, and the technology exists to change those leaking tanks into glass, and our government awarded the Hanford nuclear waste site $55 million, and they need $500 million. The $55 will guarantee it fails. My point is, if we think we can rely on technology, that ain't the issue. We got the technology for now. That's the example. We got the technology exists, but we don't have the political will or the energy to give impetus to that political will to make take advantage of those technological advances. We already got some of them, and I understand that. I think sometimes we look at that as a crutch. But technology will save us. There's something that's got to come first, and that's the will to even use it.
That's right, because if you went back to Detroit and looked in their shelves, all these SUVs could be making 25 or 30 miles to the gallon.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's one more time. It's the energy department that's saying, no, you put that stuff away. All those guys that develop stuff in their garages and send them in for patents, you got sucked up and thrown on a shelf.
We need to wrap up here in just a few minutes, but I just want to put out a question here and see, would anyone dare to bring God into this conversation? In the sense of some hope that we can't see, what would be the transcendent within our faith here? What does anything come to mind? Boy, this is daunting and impossible stuff here. Does our faith speak to that?
I would. I keep hearing about the haves and the have-nots, and in this country, I see. On a political level, like growing isolationism, a lot of anti-terrorist intelligence, a lot of things in the public imagination that were being targeted by lots of various areas, and under huge climate disruptions, the haves and the have-nots that gap is going to grow more, and I feel like our fear of being targeted, you know, is going to grow more the bigger that gap is, and we're suffering because of that. I think people on top suffer, maybe not to the extent, but there's a lot of insecurity in being on top, and I think the Bible is full of lots of phrases, like the first shall be last, the last shall be first, and history is full of lots of examples of power mongers, you know, being overrun by the people, and I would just like to see us wake up that... I think there's a lot of suffering in this country and are caused by our will to hold on to things and control. And Ben's sermon the other night about affluenza seems really problematic.
I think one specific concept really coming out of the First Testament tradition is the Jubilee concept, which we have begun to celebrate regularly here in Holden, but it also extended to this Jubilee 2000 international effort to reverse some of the debt in the developing countries. It's very specifically coming from a religious tradition that has two parts. One is the restoration of the land. Give it a rest. And I think all of this falls within this care of creation, realizing that it is finite and you have to live with it. But the other is, what other reason would you voluntarily redistribute wealth? You know, except that there is foundationally some sense that your wealth is not yours personally, but that it is somehow a part of this creation, and that if every 50 years you're going to try and get back to a right order. And I mean, it's one of the things that I, you know, if Holden is supposed to be trying to think cutting edge around what kind of call do we have? I really think this renewal of the Jubilee concept, which was once agricultural, but now it can be brought into the global sphere, and it is already developing for, and it's ready for greater enhancement. People could go from here, and we could do more with the Jubilee concept relative to issues of energy and redistribution of wealth, and it has, you know, all kinds of implications. But it's one of the most specific things that comes to my mind relative to not only the challenge or the sense of responsibility, but a way to step forward.
Yes. And it's already an international network, I understand, Diane. It's, yeah, so. Well, good. Well, I sort of hate to stop, but I think we're at that hour, aren't we? Did you have...
I have a couple of quotes that I think might be useful in our common struggle about this. I was part of the help and to think this through too. One's from Rosemary Ruther, and it's on the beginning of the 21st century, the human experiment and the biosphere stand in profound jeopardy. Whole horsemen of destruction, human population explosion at the expense of plants and animals of Earth, environmental damage to air, water, and soil, the misery of growing masses of the poor, and the global militarization aimed at retaining just advantage over the Earth's resources for a wealthy elite, create a combined set of catastrophic scenarios. Those with the greatest power seem determined to refuse to take these danger signs seriously and instead plan to keep business as usual in place, even as the capacity of the planet to sustain such business erodes. And then more hopefully from Reverend Sharon Delgado, each time we install an energy-efficient light bulb, it can be an act of faithfulness. Each time we ride our bike or take a bus or walk instead of driving, it is a spiritual victory. Each time we plant a tree, it is a sign of hope. Each time we struggle to bring the necessary changes to our church, our community, our nation, or our world, we engage in action that can lead to change. Each time we make decisions that will lead to a better world for a grandchild or niece or nephew or a child in Bangladesh, we share our faith in God who raised Jesus from the dead, who through the power of the Holy Spirit can work through us today to bring about God's future.
Would you be willing to stand a minute and just hold hands with someone to close, and we continue these conversations informally? And I simply invite you to see this gathering as a sign of hope, that to sit in the presence of impossible questions with one another and in our faith. And so let's just be quiet, just a few seconds in that hope. And the questions are hard and seem impossible, but we are people of hope. Would you like to say that together? We're people of hope?
We are people of hope.
Thank you for coming tonight.